This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
There's no better feeling than a personal win. And the State Farm Personal Price Plan can help you do just that. Talk to a State Farm agent today to learn how you can bundle and save with the Personal Price Plan. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Prices are based on rating plans that vary by state. Coverage options are selected by the customer. Availability, amount of discounts and savings, and eligibility vary by state.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. This is Garki, and today I have with me Dr. J. Danian Elam. He is an assistant professor at the Department of Comparative Literature at the University of Hong Kong. He writes about activism, anti-colonial revolutionaries, anti-racist thinkers, third world solidarity, anti-apartheid movements, and aid activism. He is the author of many books, most notably of World Literature for the Wretched of the Earth, Anti-Colonial Aesthetics, Post-Colonial Politics, published with the Fordham University Press in 2020. And for this book, he has very kindly accepted to join me today. Hello, Dr. Elam. How are you today?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
As always, I'd like to start with the genesis of this book. How did this book come to be? What were some initial ideas when you started writing this book?
So, I mean, the book was originally a dissertation. That's the most kind of pragmatic line I took. But the dissertation and the kind of project overall began with me asking a few questions, having a few questions about the kind of status of political thought. I mean, I was what I felt like was absent in a lot of political theory was these was notions of a kind of egalitarianism rooted in imperfection rather than perfection, utopias that were flawed or merely sufficient. And what I found, when I read thinkers like Bhagat Singh, Har Dayal, but then later, Gandhi and Ambedkar, were that these were theorists to me that were really thinking through a makeshift meantime project of egalitarianism, a project of really truly, which I find to be truly revolutionary in a kind of sense that it's not about perfectionism, it's not about kind of self-cultivation in some kind of, in pure to purity sense. And I really thought that that was a kind of really exciting, revolutionary way of seeing, of tracking our thinking through a political philosophy for a world that was not in existence. So it's a normative political philosophy, a world that is not yet here, but should absolutely be here. And what to do when we aren't living in that world and before we get to that world. And so that was a kind of question that I found myself asking over and over again. How do these thinkers think through that? And especially at a moment in the 1920s and 30s, where in the wake of World War I, the kind of truly a globally horrific war, you have people really trying to figure out what to do now that the so-called promises of the 19th century have been fulfilled in their most horrific form, and you have people trying to figure out what to do to recover a world that should have been that couldn't have ended up in World War I. And so you have this kind of pessimistic utopianism of the 20s that stretches around the world. But I think its most vibrant forms are to be found in anti-colonial thought, especially in South Asia. This is a moment when the British Raj is beginning to truly sour, but it doesn't look like it's going to go away. So you have these thinkers who are trying to think about the horrors of colonialism, the injustices of empire, and trying to imagine a world that absolutely must exist after that and without that. But it's not here yet. And it might not, I think the pessimism of the 30s and the 20s and the 30s was that I think for thinkers like Bhagat Singh, for Gandhi, this was a world that they were not expecting to live to see. And certainly Lala Har Dayal and Bhagat Singh did not live to see it. Gandhi lived to see it, and Gandhi lived to see technically the end of the British Raj, but was not particularly the world after 1947 was not the one that he'd imagined. And the same was certainly true for Mbeki, who watched every kind of utopian vision that he had for an anti-caste politics slowly get written out of the constitution he'd written into the 1950s. But I wanted to capture these thinkers at a moment where they were the kind of most wildly imaginative, because they did not have to hold it up to some rubric of success, eventual success, right? And so this is a kind of an anti-colonialism, the meantime in the waiting room of history, for those who won't likely live to see it come about, which is going to be deeply flawed, which is going to have lots of imperfections, which is going to be about kind of minor ways of taking care of our comrades and friends. I mean, that was what I was finding was a really sort of vibrant, exciting conversation that was being had around the world, especially in South Asia and under the British Raj in the 1920s. And I was really kind of interested in staying there and figuring out how that kind of thought came to be, what those conversations look like, and how we might kind of rethink anti-colonial thought without thinking about it in some kind of post 47 looking backwards kind of way, but rather anti-colonial thought in that moment of its own creation. That's the project of the book.
And before we come to South Asia, I want to have a little detour at Franz Fanon, who also inspires, I think, the title of the book. And you have a very intriguing sentence that states that he lived long enough to silently examine and proofread Jean-Paul Sartre's preface to his work, only to end up feeling disappointed. And I asked myself the possible reasons behind this disappointment and whether we have any evidence to support his disappointment, the fact that he was disappointed. Did he write something? How was his reaction?
So the title gives away the two kind of bookends of the book. One is world literature, which is I'm indebted to the kind of comparative philologists, most of whom were Jews, trying to escape Nazi Germany. So someone like Auerbach, and Wretched of the Earth, which is obviously, right, as you said, Franz Fanon. And the disappointment, I think, that you're talking about in this case is both general and specific. One would be, he was, according to, kind of anecdotally, he was disappointed, though necessarily happy, I guess, with Jean-Paul Sartre's introduction. I mean, Jean-Paul Sartre giving your book an introduction in the 1960s and 1950s was a huge deal. I mean, this is a celebrity endorsement, but yet that introduction to The Wretched of the Earth is in some ways just a wild misreading. I mean, I don't want to claim that I have the right reading of Fanon, but this introduction seems perpetually exceptionally misguided. So anecdotally, right, Franz Fanon was disappointed with the introduction, though he knew it was a sort of requirement for getting this book on the shelves. So there's that disappointment. That's the kind of sort of rumors, anecdotes, friends of friends and friends and friends of friends in books saying. Then the disappointment I think I was trying to capture, in the sentiment of that, right, was this disappointment that Franz Fanon is writing at a moment, this is in the late 50s and early 60s. This is a moment where, Franz Fanon was on his deathbed. He lived only a few days after the publication of the book. So disappointment after that is difficult to know, doesn't exist. The disappointment kind of more broadly that I think I was trying to capture there was the disappointment that comes about around late 1950s. And I'm trying to think more about this now, actually, around the world that is technically post-colonial, but certainly isn't. And I guess in Franz Fanon's case, right, he was thinking about French Africa and French Caribbean, that world was still very much in place. The French Empire was quite strong and very nasty and active at one. The disappointment that I was trying to capture was this one where the world that was supposed to have been brought about was not particularly different than the world that that existed before it. And so so Franz Fanon's disappointment that the colonial world continues to live on, and that anger that you can see, the rage that you see, the phenomenal anger that you see coming off the page in Wretched of the Earth, alongside this kind of really careful meditation on a number of different things, right? That's a disappointment of a world that should be otherwise and still yet isn't. And I think that's what I was trying to capture there.
And we'll come to world literature, but before, just to bother you a little bit more about the disappointment. You say that Fanon had the skill to communicate effectively with his fellow anti-colonial thinkers while remaining comprehensible to the colonizers. And is that the interpretation that we can take from this, that these anti-colonial thoughts are not open to the colonizer?
So I think there's a way that I want to read that I think it's not... I mean, the colonizer's incomprehensibility is a choice of the colonizer, right? I mean, when you read Jean-Paul Sartre's introduction, you see this kind of bravado that actually and sort of prohibits him from even reading Fanon, right? So it's not that Fanon is incomprehensible. Clearly, if he was incomprehensible, we couldn't read him. But there's a certain type of writing which is made possible in which anti-colonialism makes possible, which is about an infinitely open invitation to comrades and friends and infinite family, right? So this infinitely open invitation, sometimes to the point of being dangerous, right, which allows Fanon to speak kind of wildly inclusive, first person plural, we, right? This is his address is also is French Fanon often uses this kind of comrades, we must blah 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 blah. So he's this kind of infinitely open first person plural as a form of invitation, and yet, right, even as he's speaking to comrades, people who wish to be his comrades, people who are in an anti-colonial mission with him, right? He can never, like, that is a moment of wild comprehensibility and wild, he can be understood, right? And yet, right, a certain colonialism then renders that comradeship, that infinite orientation, either as a threat or either as a kind of an exclusive we. And so it's that which is the incomprehensible. It's not like a fundamental incomprehensibility of France Fanon. That would be unfortunate. I mean, selfishly speaking, but it's in fact kind of, it's an open invitational first person plural, which renders something comprehensible to comrades while theorizing its own kind of incomprehensibility to power, to authority, to colonial authority. I think, and then sort of the person who gets at this the best for me in the book, is Gandhi, right? Gandhi, who creates this impressive set of vocabulary to describe what he's up to, borrowing from Sanskrit, borrowing from Gujarati, translated to English, translated back to Sanskrit, translated back to Sanskrit, Gujarati. I mean, it's kind of wild backflips of vocabulary and lexicon that make that make possible a sort of vocabulary of anti-colonialism, but a vocabulary of non-violence, right? So ahimsa, brahmacharya, satyagraha, all of these words he is able to use to be both comprehensible, both understandable in a new sort of way, but also wildly incomprehensible. Imagine showing up to London and speaking gibberish Sanskrit to the colonial power. I mean, this is a kind of phenomenal performance of incomprehensibility, which is yet at the same time gesturing towards solidarity, comrades, and friends.
And because of its incomprehensibility, is a question. We should talk about philology, and you have blended philology with anti-colonial thought. And I was wondering, because I have not come across many instances where these fields are used together or intertwined so seamlessly. Is this integration a part of an academic tradition that I'm ignorant of, or is this something that you observed a need for while working on your sources?
I have to say, this is a fantastic question. It's a question that... I have to admit, hadn't occurred to me before last fall when someone asked me a very similar question, and it took me by surprise. And I guess it's not. You have not missed an academic field. You've not missed kind of a new trend in academic study. I wish I could say that, but no, I think it hasn't set itself up as a trend quite yet. But I must also admit that it is equally true that I didn't put these two fields together because I thought that they should be, which is the reason I put them together is I thought that they were and already in conversation. In my mind, they were asking a similar question. So if, when you read the book, it doesn't seem very often that I am committed to making an argument that we should be reading anti-colonial and philosophy and philology together. I realize now as axiomatic that why we are reading anti-colonial thought and philology together. I have plenty of justifications for that, but it never felt to me to be an urge. It felt to me just perhaps by virtue of reading them at the same time of my life, you know, my early 20s, you know, that they went together naturally. And it sort of did the work to justify that perhaps a little bit in the book. But the book really treats sort of as an axiom, as a kind of grounding axiom, that these two bodies of thought, which are wildly different, anti-colonial thought and philology, simply should be put together, simply already are in conversation, or just, you know, just should be, but not with a kind of, you know, not with the force of a kind of academic intervention in the first instance. So, I mean, Ramsey McGlazier really helpfully called this an offbeat pairing. I mean, so it's a pairing that, but I have to admit that it's a pairing that I didn't think about needing to, I didn't think about it being counterintuitive. I didn't think about it being necessary. I thought about it as sort of true to me. which is to say, but I think that there are really important reasons for doing it. Right? So I don't think I wasn't just kind of floundering in the dark, though maybe I was also doing that. I think anti-colonial thought and philology have a lot in common. And I think those things are worth really foregrounding here. One is that they are contemporaneous. So you have this emergence of comparative philology in Germany and France, mostly in the 1920s and 30s. And at the same time, you have this is when Gandhi and Bhagat Singh and Ambedkar's career and takes off. A large part of comparative philology are Jews writing under the context of Nazism, and so what they are trying to imagine is a world literature. That would survive them. I mean, this is the pathos of a lot of early comparative literature texts coming in out of Germany and France. And you have in India, you have a group of people who are writing about a world that should exist after colonialism. So you have two. So you have on one hand an aesthetic project which is inherently political, and you have a political project which is necessarily aesthetic. And by putting those in conversation, I think that they reveal that commitment to a world that must be otherwise, and yet that's kind of that commitment is imbued with this sort of dismal realization, though also I think really revolutionary, that we won't live to see that world. It must exist and we must fight for it, but we won't, it seems unlikely that we'll make it. And so I think that seems to me to be the conversation that these two otherwise seemingly distinct, discrete bodies of thought have. I think that they belong in conversation, but it's a sort of thing that happened, and that justification happened after the fact. After I have to work backwards from the fact that I just thought that they were. So, you know, the contemporaneity, the kind of shared political commitments, the shared aesthetic commitments, I think are both, you know, very present throughout both bodies of thought.
And now coming to the people that you have discussed in quite detail, and you have brought together Lala Hardayal, B.R. Ambedkar, M.K. Gandhi, and Bhagat Singh to analyze anti-colonial thought and practices in South Asia. So the question begs, why these four, and among all of the anti-colonial thought that is there?
Yeah, there's so many fantastic anti-colonial thinkers to read slowly, and you know, most books require that you choose. I mean, most studies require that you choose maybe four or one or two. So there's that conflict. I mean, when I was, one thing that I think is a, I think the book, you know, the book is. is absent, you know, and embarrassingly so, from the women who were the colleagues of all of these anti-colonial thinkers, and who they treated as comrades and also adversaries and also friends. This book is a man-heavy book. I think the reason that that is nevertheless important, and the reason why these four thinkers are stand out, is that what I was interested in doing was taking the most kind of masculine seeming founding fathers of India, or the kind of, you know, the founding fathers of India in some kind of mastery sense, and showing that they themselves, despite this kind of overwhelming kind of posthumous masculinity, posthumous hero hagiographic worship that has been placed upon them, were theorizing their own inconsequence and their own insufficiency and their own imperfection in a way that like these kind of masculinist hagiographic approaches tend to totally ignore. And so they were theorizing away from their own masculinity. Someone like Gandhi was in fact very kind of overtly theorizing away from his own masculinity, often to somewhat clunky results. But you know, even someone like Bhagat Singh, who has this kind of wildly, you know, bomb throwing hero, aura about him, right, was also theorizing, debating with his colleagues about how many eggs to eat. He was also having crushes on Bollywood actresses. He was doing all of these things, which were just simply what he would do as a normal person. He's 20 years old, but these are the things that get written out of the stories we tell about anti-colonial activists. When we want to make them the heroes, when we want to make them the great men of history, these are the first things that go, because they are insufficiently masculine, they're insufficiently heroic, they're insufficiently political. And I was wanting to actually really foreground these insufficiencies as the basis of an anti-colonial politics, which I think that was the case for these four thinkers. So, you know, so in some ways, I chose the most kind of overtly masculine or most overtly masterful thinkers of anti-colonial thought in order to actually show that they themselves were not committed to that, and were in fact committed to the opposite. Were committed to kind of theorizing, a much quieter, a much more or less recognizably political politics.
Now coming to the world literature, and I was curious why you used world literature as a term, because, for example, Goethe would say, you know, I could pick a book from any part and then compare them, which, and it has been correctly pointed out, I'm not the first one to say, is that it undermines the complex political, colonial, social forces that brought these texts, these translations into Europe. And how can we now use world literature to do exactly the opposite, which is to further our comprehension of world literature's anti-colonial mission? How do we do this switch?
I think it's about understanding maybe one way of saying the one way of putting it would be to say that world literature stands to me as something that is theorized to be impossibly masterful. And yet, when we go back to some of the founding texts in world literature, even we kind of think about what world literature is and what we do when we say we do world literature, it's actually kind of grounded in a wildly insufficient practice. I mean, so first off, the project of world literature, to read the books of the world, is an absurdly impossible project, and what you find is a lot of people really early on, and certainly in the comparative philology world, were really committed to foregrounding the impossibility of it, right? So on one hand, you have Goethe, who can pick up a Chinese novel and or Chinese, or like Hafez or something like this, and you there's this, you know, that gloss of mastery about being able to pick up any novel and understand all of the world, all of the literature. But I think equally so, you have a great tradition of people who say this, I'm a human. Even if there are 20 of me, we're not going to read all of the world and its literature. And why don't we start from that? Why don't we start from a project which is going to be perpetually incomplete, perpetually insufficient, and build up from that? Or you also have a project where world literature is not a given thing, right? But rather a thing that should exist in a world to come, a world that is after fascism. So one of the world literature is a world is literature for a world that is properly worldly, and that's another strain. But the dominant strain, you're absolutely right, is one of that's rooted fundamentally in nationalism. I mean, even from Goethe's Romanticism to anthologies of world literature for American university students, these are projects which are about fundamentally instilling a certain nationalist sentiment. I mean, the rubrics of world literature, the syllabi of world literature, all country-based, right? Read German novels, read French novels. And they rely heavily on the nationalist sentiment. That's what, I mean, that's very much what Goethe was about in his own way. And certainly what Goethe has been taken up to be. And the Nazis, Venkat Mani has shown, right? The Nazis were really committed to world literature, Weltliteratur, as one of the world-conquering projects. So, I mean, I think, on one hand, right, I'm interested in reviving that tradition where we start with world literature as a fundamentally impossible project, where we don't know what the world is, we don't know what literature is, and we simply read in hopes of putting that together, in conversation with colleagues around us, and conversations with colleagues to come, conversations with friends we'll never meet. And I'm also interested, I mean, I think somewhat stubbornly, then you could also say, I'm also interested in taking two projects which were, so anti-colonialism and world literature, two projects which were famously invested in nationalism and reading them without nationalism. So I think, you know, what happens when we read world literature as a non-nationalist project, what somewhat stubbornly and somewhat more stubbornly, perhaps, what happens when we going against a lot of, you know, historiography and anti-colonial thought, what happens when we read anti-colonial thought without as though it's not nationalist, or as though nationalism is not a solved, not an answered question, right? So in that sense, I mean, it's a sort of stubborn project in that sense, but I do think that there's a project in world literature that's been there from the beginning, which might be slightly quieter than the more domineering imperial approaches, but which is one that is about fundamentally a different way of reading, a different way of doing criticism that is not about world coverage. It's not about imperial knowledge production, but rather one that's simply about critique, and critique that's communal, critique that's collective, critique that is that begins from point of its own insufficiency and starts a project from that point, rather than to start a project from the idea that all of literature in all of the world might be read and known and comprehended. I think that's the project I want to avoid. I think that's the basis for a lot of, as you point out correctly, that's the basis for a lot of world literature syllabi and goals. That project I want to rethink. I want to ditch that project in favor of something that's much quieter and much more collective in its form of criticism.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
This episode is brought to you by Captain Morgan Sliced. Since the dawn of bread, people have known the truth. Sliced is better. That's why new Captain Morgan Sliced went all in on four bold, deliciously sliced cocktail-style flavors. Pineapple Daiquiri, Strawberry Margarita, Mango Mai Tai, and Passion Fruit Hurricane. Visit CaptainMorgan.com to find Sliced near you. Does not contain real fruit or juice. Captain Morgan & Co., Plainfield, Illinois. Please drink responsibly. 21 plus only.
And now, turning to Lala Hardayal and his unique approach to reading. And there is this, again, this very intriguing incident where he has immense fear of publishing his book in India. And surprisingly, when it went to the censors, they did not find it political at all. And I was thinking, is that an example to exemplify what you were saying about Fanu as like being incomprehensible to the colonial thought? And additionally, I'm interested in understanding the significance of reading that Lala Hardayal attributed to anti-colonial movement for the sake of the people who have not yet read the book.
Yeah, thank you so much. Those are two really helpful questions to put together. So, I'll work a little backwards. So reading for me is the thing which anti-colonial reading is the kind of location where I saw anti-colonial thinkers, the ones in this book, theorizing the radical egalitarian politics that I was talking about earlier, right? So it's when I went to read these thinkers, what I found as the moment where they start to begin to theorize this radical egalitarianism that's both impossible and necessary and so on, is usually around when they talk about their own reading practices, when they theorize what they want to be doing when they read or what they think we should be doing when they read. So I'm not interested in empirical reading practices here, but I'm interested in the theory of reading or how they theorize reading in their work. So the book that you're talking about is Hints for Self-Culture. It's a very curious book. It's you can still find it in I found it in Delhi, and so it's available. I don't think it's fully out of print. It's not really done. It's not a bestseller, but it's around. You can get yourself a copy. Hardayal wrote it in a considerably after he'd left the Ghadar Party and had moved to Europe. He'd been to Turkey and he'd been to Germany and he had a kind of tumultuous set of years. And then he publishes this book in 1934, and he means it truly as, so the book is called Hints for Self-Culture. It begins with this kind of process of self-cultivation, which looks vaguely like a 19th century self-cultivation guide, but then moves really, really kind of quickly to this really broad imagination for what a world state might look like rooted in friendship. It's this idea that, we do these things, we self-cultivate in favor of this production of a kind of transnational, internationalist world to come, such that they will look back upon us and say, wow, they did the work. Not that we would live there, but in fact that the future generation would send us back an acknowledgement of some sort. Not for that, but that would be the thing. Right? So the book is a curious book, as I said. So it has chapters on how many times you should chew food, what food you should eat, what languages you should learn, what genres of books you should read, and all of these things, who you should read with. And I mean, it's really actually very invested in reading. Lala Hardayal thought it was, considered it to be political, but was very anxious about his publication in India because he was trying to actually to get back to India. He'd been kicked out, he'd been exiled. The British censors read it and deemed it, as you said, insufficiently political. I think regardless of the decision, I think what's curious about it is this concept of the insufficiently political, which I think we have retained even as we've moved from a colonial reading practice, like the British did in this moment, to an anti-colonial reading or post-colonial reading practice, where we have a rubric for what counts as political that is inherited from the British Raj, not from anywhere else. And so when we read a text and we deem it to be insufficiently political or improperly political, I think what we're doing is a really serious, in one sense, it sort of saved Hardayal in this one instance, but it owes its That kind of form of reading is indebted to a colonial practice of surveillance and critique, not another one. And so I think I wanted to show that the way that we have always read Hardayal, as you know, one part is the other party, which is properly political. The other part is this kind of weird, flimsy, new agey Hardayal, which is writing in Sweden, is improperly political. I think that is a false binary that we have to give up, I think, for proper post-colonial criticism. I think we cannot rely on this rubric of the insufficiently political that we've been handed from the British Raj to understand how we read text. We have to think of, in other words, what we have to do is we have to take as truth the fact that for Hardayal, this was a very political book, and we have to work out from that what political means in this context, not apply our own rubrics for whether, and then judge it as to its insufficiency. And so, yeah, I mean, then the project begins, what about this book is political? And because certainly for Hardayal it was, and how do we read this book as, you know, and then that is a different reading practice, I think, that we have to think through, right, than the one that allowed it to pass the British censors. That's what I was trying to get at.
And that leads very nicely into the reading materials of Bhagat Singh, which have not been given sufficient attention because of non-instrumentality, which we can compare with not being political enough, not bringing out his, you know, masculinity of being that bomb thrower. Can you elaborate on what this theory of non-instrumentality entails when we read Bhagat Singh?
Yeah, so for Bhagat Singh, what I did, the methodology for each chapter is a little different, or kind of how I approach each thinker is a little different. For Bhagat Singh, what I was interested in doing was reading his jail notebooks. And so these are not the kind of more, these are not the philosophy of the bomb, this is not why I'm an atheist. These are his jail notebooks. And what we have, what post-colonial criticism has tended to do is read these jail notebooks as proof of the of his eventual mastery, that he was studying communism, that he was studying the Bolsheviks, that he was studying the Irish Republican Army, that he was studying these to be a master of anti-colonial activism, to be a master of worldwide socialism, and so on. But the notebooks themselves are not that. I mean, they are a document of his reading practices. They are notes that he's taking from books. They are quotes that he's copied down. While he is in jail and sentenced to life, and beyond the point in which he had, I mean, and at a point in which he had accepted that he would be hanged at the age of 23, this was a moment where he was not reading for eventual mastery. And the eventual mastery that we wish for him is this kind of fantasy that we have. Had he lived on, you know, had he lived, he would have written four books about communism. We don't, I mean, that's an admittedly very alluring thing to speculate about. But what we have here is a journal, a notebooks of notes, of something that looks more like a commonplace, right? Where Bhagat Singh has copied down direct quotes. He's kind of, you know, made some remarks here and there. But it's really truly a document of, not of eventual mastery, but actually current, inexpertise, current noviceness. I think by kind of foregrounding that in the jail notebook, Bhagat Singh is kind of gesturing, or pushing us to think sort of differently about the project of anti-colonialism as one of mastery versus one of, you know, inexpertise in the present. This was an anti-colonial project for Bhagat Singh, and so trying to take seriously what that means then is I think the goal that, this should be the charge of our criticism, our way of our analysis. The reason I think that, I mean, I think the what makes that a project, what makes that project worthwhile is Bhagat Singh's commitment to the non-instrumentality, non-usefulness of reading. Reading is not a useful practice. It does not produce anything. It's not instrumentalizable. But rather, it's sort of pleasure in and of itself. It's a pleasure in the present. It's a way of actually, I mean, it's certainly for Bhagat Singh, it's a way of interacting with his friends and comrades. Right? They read and then they discussed and they debated and they argued. This was a way of being with friends as you were waiting for a death which you were completely certain would arrive, and very soon. And so this is not a non-instrumentalized, non-useful, non-pragmatic, and it's not pragmatic in that sense, it's non-utilitarian, right? I mean, it's a way of thinking about anti-colonialism. It's a way of thinking about revolution, I think, for Bhagat Singh, more importantly. It's a way of thinking about revolution, which is not about the number of utils it will eventually accrue or the value it will eventually be worth, but rather the value in and of itself in the moment, in the present, in that sense, right? That's the revolutionary project of reading that Bhagat Singh, I think, is gesturing towards.
Yeah. And comparably is also to this non-usefulness is Gandhi's reading for failure. Can you also elaborate on why failure, reading for failure, is what, how we can understand better Gandhi's reading practices?
So, I mean, I think Gandhi has a, I mean, Gandhi has a much different approach. I think what Gandhi is trying to think through is a form of inexpertise, perhaps, I mean, which is invested in reading or committed to reading, a form of inexpertise which is about being treated, given up as immature, given up as foolish. All of these practices, I mean, so, I think what's exciting about a lot of the work and around Gandhi has been that it's done really brilliant things to kind of elucidate his thought. It's connected it to other kind of thinkers in the world at the time, both in the 1920s, but also more contemporary thinkers like Hannah Arendt or Derrida. But I think what I find to be exciting, and as I completely admire all of that work, I'm indebted to it. What I find exciting about Gandhi is actually where we can't help him out of his own mess. He creates situations which he is bound to mess up. He creates situations in which he is open, guaranteed to fail. And he creates situations where he's simply the logics of Ahimsa, the logics of Satyagraha, they don't work. We can't solve them for Gandhi. And I don't think that, I mean, it's very clear throughout Gandhi's writings that Gandhi didn't want them solved. He enjoyed the mess of his philosophy. And so I wanted to think through what it means to be, to treat Gandhi like the mess that he says he is, right? I think a lot of criticism of that chapter has been about me trusting Gandhi a little too much, right? I mean, he often uses this as a kind of evasive tool, and it gets him out of a lot of trouble sometimes. I'm just foolish. Don't listen to me, when he's actually doing something quite authoritative in that moment. That's true. I just wanted to take seriously the possibility of what it means to make a messy philosophy and to use that as a basis for an insufficient revolutionary politics, right? So again, this is about imperfection. It's about insufficiency. It's about, in Gandhi's case, I think Gandhi really was really trying to push towards this kind of really wildly radical, extreme form of inexpertise and foolishness and novice-ness, and that led him to some really clunky outcomes and some clunky places. But that theory of the wildly insufficient, the wildly immature, the wildly inexpert, the wild inexpertise, right, I think is really exciting as a way of grounding an anti-colonial politics that I think we should be paying more attention to, rather than trying to figure out how to make Gandhi's anti-colonial politics logical or make sense or be worth something. I think we might take a moment to go back with Gandhi and be a little bit foolish. Which leads me to read Hinsraj in a different way. The book that he wrote in 1909, and in 1939 he said he wouldn't change a word, right, is this dialogue between, it's dialogue about India under self-rule, which is between an editor and a reader. And we kind of tend to think, because the editor is making a lot of the points, that the reader is someone, perhaps the British, perhaps more revolutionary thinkers, perhaps even Nehru sometimes or whatever, and the editor is Gandhi, right? But I think what we find when we read Hinsraj over the course, we can track alongside Gandhi's career, is that Gandhi was really gesturing towards being the reader and having the authorities be somewhere else. So the dialogue is not so clear cut, a kind of Gandhi, the editor, the reader, just someone who's recalcitrant. But knowing what we know about Gandhi's recalcitrance, right? Gandhi, I think, was gesturing towards being the reader himself. So I think that's the way to kind of think through a different, a project of inexpertise that Gandhi was certainly thinking through. At the same time, right? And these are, again, I mean, to be clear, all of these thinkers are simultaneously theorizing really grand heroic gestures. Bhagat Singh is arguing about books at the same time he's throwing bombs. I'm not trying to separate these. I'm not trying to hide one of the other, but I want to kind of foreground the ones that we tend to drop out. And that's what I'm doing here with Gandhi.
Yeah. And this failure is also interesting when we come to the last thinker, which is Ambedkar. And you have portrayed with great clarity that these anti-colonial thinkers did not live long to see their idea in fruition. And when we come to Ambedkar, he did not succumb to despair or nihilism, rather embraced this hope of non-theological egalitarianism. Admits the sad reality that post-independence of India presented itself. To help those who are listening here, could you elaborate on what this means when we read, for example, Ambedkar's not Ambedkar's failure, as in that the country's failure in front of what Ambedkar's project was?
That's a very good question. I think Ambedkar was constantly critical of nationalist anti-colonialism, precisely because he did not see that there would be difference between Dalits being ruled by the British or Dalits being ruled by Brahmins. And certainly what you see as he presents the draft constitution, which is this brilliant document which has all of these kind of juridical activism for the protection of scheduled castes and lower castes and untouchable people, in the meantime of the, as we are on the way to eradicating caste entirely. I mean, it's a really beautiful document. And what he watched, it's not only what he kind of watched come true in some sense, right, is the caste and the oppression of caste, the injustice of caste, and the lives of Dalits didn't change substantially between the British Raj and post-independent India, and certainly as he watched his constitution be drafted further away from him, this became a realization. So in some ways, this is precisely what his turn. It was not a turn at that moment to Buddhism. It was a long, lifelong reflection on Buddhism. But Buddhism opened up this possibility to leave that moment and leave with others, and yet stay committed to Dalits who could not leave. Right, and so it was this kind of really wild, really kind of imaginative reworking of Buddhism for an anti-caste politics and for Dalit solidarity. There are plenty of places where Ambedkar is overtly critical of nationalist anti-colonialism. There are plenty of places after 47, before he dies, where Ambedkar is critical of the Indian government. I think what I find fascinating about Ambedkar in this moment is not that, though I'm interested in that in a separate way. But here I was really interested, in the book, I was really interested in how he theorizes an anti-caste politics as an anti-authoritarian politics. And so in some ways what he does, what he does by this kind of really brilliant philological reading of Manushmiti, right, is that he actually shows that an anti-caste politics is anti-colonial because caste politics is so committed to a certain type of colonial politics. and the kind of Orientalism of Sanskrit instruction and translation and, you know, under the British East India Company to the British Raj and so on. So what he's doing is not simply just kind of refusing caste, but he's actually showing the complete complete irrelevance, I would say, of its own authority. Right? At the center of caste's authority is Manu and his laws. The Manu Smriti gives all of these laws and authorial practices for how one, authoritative practices for how one should do caste, and how one should perpetuate caste injustice. What Ambedkar finds when he goes to read Manu Smriti, and he does this beautiful reading of the Manu Smriti, which just shows it's a mess. It's an irrelevant document. It's nonsensical in a way that is, it reveals its own nonsense. And so what is, so there's the insanity of the madness, the madness of Manu and Victor's words, the insanity of caste, right, is that it relies on an authoritative practice that its authority can't hold up. And so, you know, this kind of the authority of caste, the authority of colonial structure, you know, these are not simply, it's one thing to refute them and to kind of stage your own, but I mean, the risk I suppose you would run would be, you know, asserting a new authority in place of the old. But what Ambedkar does really brilliantly, and it's really beautifully, is really show that at the heart of caste's authority and a caste authoritative power is actually there's no there. The center doesn't exist, and so, you know, caste authority is completely irrelevant. And so the annihilation of caste is not one of refuting caste, but rather one of annihilating it, making it totally irrelevant. I think that's Ambedkar's kind of brilliant insight here. That was my reading in that chapter.
Thank you for this clarification. Now, we're almost at the end. And since this book was published almost 3 years ago, 2.5, something like that, and you had some opportunity to have some feedback from the readers. But I would like to here give an opportunity for you to say, what do you hope the readers take from this book? How do you hope the readers read this book?
I've been so incredibly lucky to have interacted with readers who read it in ways that I couldn't have imagined that they would. So I feel like saying the things that I want readers to do would just actually be boring at this point. The readers that I've had, it's been really, really amazing. The readers that have engaged with the book, have engaged with it in ways that I have really made me rethink a lot of the work. I mean, I stand by the book in some sense, but I've been pushed to think in really different ways. People like Ajay Skoya, Shruti Kapila, and have really kind of challenged the kind of way that I've thought about these thinkers on the same page. I mean, I would like to, that would be one thing I'd want to revisit. And other thinkers other people that I've heard from, other readers, have just pushed the book to do things that I didn't think the book could do. And so it's in some ways, that's the reading that if I were to imagine what I wanted, it doesn't compare to what I've seen happen in some of the readings and responses and criticisms that have really made the book more exciting than I thought it could be. And I've been really grateful for that. I think, I think that the way that I've been made to think about the book in the past 3 years, you know, after its publication, I thought maybe the book was done. And the book is in many ways done, but I really, the engagements, the criticisms, the responses have been so helpful for me to go back and actually think about what I was doing there and how I, you know, and for me, that's been absolutely, that's been the best part about having written a book. It's not fun to write a book for yourself. It's fun to read. You want to write a book for others. And you know, the academic monograph has a number of different tasks that it must perform in the institution of in the academy. And yet I've been able to have this book do something slightly different by having a set of engaged readers who've made it much more exciting than me talking into the void, hearing my voice repeated back at me. A book about, I mean, you would think that it's a bit idiotic that a book about someone who writes a book about readers being revolutionary isn't surprised that readers are revolutionary, but that's a fun thing to be surprised, idiotically surprised by repeatedly. So that's been really exciting.
And the last question, as always, what are you working on right now? What do we hope from you to read in the future?
So I'm working on a few books simultaneously, which is a bit mad. But I think the next kind of academic book is one about anti-colonial sociology. So it's a book that charts the ways that anti-colonial thinkers took up early 20th century sociology and its messiness and its vibrancy, and used it to imagine a post-colonial, decolonial world. So this is most obviously in Baker, who studied at Columbia, but it's also in Nkrumah, it's Kenyatta, it's Franz Fanon. What I'm interested in here is, in some ways, that what I was getting at a little earlier with this kind of how do you act on the post-colonial world, the post-independent world, the post-independence world, and that, you know, through the decolonial wave of the mid-20th century, right, was one where technically anti-colonialism won, but what it won was a world that was wildly far away from the world that it had envisioned and fought for. So it's a kind of technical win, but not, you know, not a win for you, the utopian strain of political philosophy that had promoted it, right? And so what I'm finding is that these kind of anti-colonial thinkers, these post-colonial thinkers, these post-independent thinkers, post-independence thinkers, turning back to their training in sociology to use the concepts of, you know, shared consciousness, social, you know, cohesiveness, solidarity. All of these thinkers are turning to those to reimagine a world that still yet must come. So even in this moment of the 1950s, in the 1960s, these thinkers are still pushing at the possibility for new modes of solidarity, new modes of political affiliation, new modes of political community that are rooted in shared consciousness, that are rooted in conscience and contrasts. These include the kind of more obvious things like Ben Dung and Afro-Asian solidarity, but actually, I'm much more interested in the kind of quieter things that are like the kind of tentative Pan-Africanisms, the proposals to the League of Nations and the UN for nations which weren't nations. So all of these kind of modes of political belonging that aren't the nation, but rather rely on this kind of more amorphous sense of solidarity that can be kind of captured under society as it was theorized in the early 20th century. So that's that book. I'm also working on a book about my uncle who died from HIV in HIV AIDS in 1993, and I'm trying to write a book about his life and, you know, how his life as an out gay man in the 1980s, as a German professor, as a German wine expert in the late 80s, how his life has shaped mine and my family's, and that's a project which is really, really important to me as well.
Both sound like wonderful projects, and I'm sure I will read them both when they're published.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining me today, and I wish you all the best for the projects.
Thank you.